The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXEF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of this show, you're free to do so. Just send us an email so we know you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.
The show is brought to you by Firestone Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestone Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events on their website at firestorm.coop.
This week, you'll hear an interview with Ben Turk about ongoing prisoner hunger strikes at Waupun Correctional Institution in Wisconsin. The hunger strikes have been running since early June and have involved almost a dozen prisoners who have faced repression, including force feeding, further isolation, transfers, and beatings for participation. The hunger strikes were initiated to protest the use of long-term solitary confinement at the institution. For the majority of the show, IWOC activist Ben Turk talks about the cases of the men involved and the circumstances they're facing. We also speak about the upcoming national prisoner strike on September 9th, 2016, and how to get involved in that. But first, a few announcements.
On July 2nd, Asheville Police Officer Tyler Radford shot and killed a 35-year-old African-American man named Jerry Williams at the Deaverview Apartments in Asheville. The following week has seen daily demonstrations and vigils in support of Jerry's family and the black communities of Asheville, and in solidarity with protests against the killings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling by police in Minneapolis and Baton Rouge, respectively. Today, there will be three more events capping off the week of resistance that listeners are urged to attend if their hearts are in it. At 2 p.m., there's a community healing and release ritual at the river at Carrier Park. At 5 p.m., there's a car ride through riding in solidarity from Pisgahview Apartments to Deaverview Apartments. And at 6 p.m., there will be a vigil at the police department in Pack Square in downtown Asheville. If you want to see a small write-up about the protests in Asheville and the circumstances of the case, you can check out It's Going Down and just search Asheville.
Manuel Salas, a vegan animal rights activist who was arrested for arson, unrelated to his animal rights activism, a few months before his 19th birthday, is scheduled to be released from prison on August 20th, 2016, after more than a decade in prison. In addition to his initial 12-year sentence, Manuel was sentenced to an additional 4.5 years after being charged with felony criminal damage to property and disorderly conduct stemming from an escalation of a protest against the facility for denying him vegan food. Manuel has been active in struggling for vegan rights within prisons during his incarceration and is the founder of the National Animal Rights and Anarchist Network. Manuel's writing was featured in issue number 2 of Wildfire. Manuel is requesting support as his release date approaches. Please take a moment to send Manuel a card of encouragement and include your contact information so he can stay in touch after his release. Or donate some money to his release fund. You can find the link up in our blog post at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. We have set up an email account for Manuel to use after he's released. Starting in late August, you can send a quick email to Manuel to see how he's doing and stay in touch at Manuel Salas, that's MANUELSALAS, at riseup.net. A word from Manuel, quote, "Hello to all, my name is Manuel Salas. I have been an animal rights activist and vegan for a long time. I have helped to make positive changes to the prison vegan diet. I'm going to be getting out of prison in August and I'm looking to get in touch with some new people. In a way, I'm looking for some friendly support. I'm into the understanding that life is a gift and that we all must get and that we must get all we can out of it. I'm looking for friends who understand that everyone in life sometimes makes mistakes but can grow from them. There are also those like me who have made sacrifices for their friends. In my case, those friends are not humans, but the animals I fight so hard to save from their oppressors. I want to move on and grow as I have over the year. I want to be able to share life with people who understand life as a gift, who can take the bad and work to make it good, to take the negative and make it a positive, to just have fun and enjoy life. I would appreciate a letter or a card. Thank you, and I hope you all have a good day. End quote. You can write to Manuel by addressing your envelopes to Manuel Salas, 504212, Columbia Correctional Institution, P.O. Box 900, Portage, Wisconsin, 53901-900.
At the time that I'm getting this recorded, this is the latest. In unrelated instances of business as usual, cops in Minnesota and Louisiana shot and killed black men for no reason, except for the fact that that's what cops do. Then, at least five cops were killed and several more were injured in Dallas, in what seems to be a revenge shooting. But wait, there's more. There's also been shootouts with police in Georgia and Tennessee. Exciting times. So look, I think it's time that we revisit the topic of what we ought to do about police shootings. The last time I dealt with the topic, I ended the segment by saying, guns don't kill people, cops do. Save lives, kill cops. And just to be clear here, I didn't know you were really going to do it. If I knew it was this easy, I would have given you cannibal maniacs whole laundry lists of people to shoot. For real, the civilized world is full of them. But I digress. I have to say, I hope what I'm saying doesn't sound insensitive. I have to say that because the team of attorneys in New York said it improves the odds of keeping the FCC off our backs if I throw in that kind of insincere disclaimer. So I did. Now let's get to the fun part. There's a lot to untangle here. First, the police shootings in Louisiana and Minnesota. As I understand it, one victim was unarmed and the other one was not. I have also heard it implied that the armed victim was a convicted criminal or something. So there's an analysis that's distinguishing the innocent victim from the one who is not. I've got a problem with that. All cops work for the oppressor. All cops are bastards. All their victims are innocent. Period. We can't be distinguishing between who we're going to defend from the oppressor from who we're not. Second, to the killing of cops. Despite what I've said for purposes of entertainment, I have to point out that killing five cops is not the solution to the problem. Killing all of them is the solution to the problem. I don't think anyone saw this coming. The cops in Dallas certainly didn't. You know the last thing to go through their minds? Slugs, the size of your thumb. Third, to the further shootings in Tennessee and Georgia. There's no indication yet as to whether these are cases of cops killing black people or cases of black people killing cops, but we can hope for the latter. Having said all of that, you can be sure that there will be no anti-cop violence here in Ohio. Sad, but there's a long history of letting cops get away with murder. There was the incident where cops shot unarmed brown people 124 times in their car. Then there was Tamir Rice in Cleveland, and then another young boy in Cincinnati gunned down by cops for playing with a toy sold in the store where he was shot. Hardly any protests occurred even after prosecutors refused to charge their bowling team members as child killers. In fact, people didn't get outraged in Ohio until cops in Cincinnati killed a lowland gorilla at the Cincinnati Zoo. The death of Harambe caused white folks to come out of the woodwork to protest and hold candlelight vigils and sign petitions. So based on all of that, you won't see anyone in Ohio wilding out against the cops. For somebody black to gain the sympathy of white folks in Ohio, he'll have to get shot wearing a big hairy gorilla suit after dragging one of their dumb kids around by the leg. But it appears that folks everywhere else are fed up. The craziest thing I saw today, a congressman speaking for the Congressional Black Caucus came out in response to the killing of cops to request a ban on assault rifles. I couldn't believe it. Still can't. Keep in mind, the Congressional Black Caucus doesn't want to take the assault rifles from the cops. The Black Caucus wants to disarm the people who are being shot by cops. Shouldn't this be the one time that black Democrats support legislation to expand the availability of assault rifles? Instead of holding a press conference, that congressman should have been driving a truck filled with loaded AR-15 rifles through downtown Baltimore and handing them out. These are his kids and grandkids used for target practice by those who oppress and enslave. Unbelievable. At the same time, President Obama was on TV saying that affirming that black lives matter doesn't mean that blue ones don't. Well, yeah, Barack, kinda does. That's like making a speech about the Holocaust and saying that affirming Jewish lives matter doesn't mean that Nazi war criminal lives don't. Ridiculous. You wouldn't see this kind of nonsense if we had a black president. Oh, wait. Now, I don't know how this ends, and I can't bring myself to unrealistic optimism that cops won't continue shooting black people. But I know of five who won't. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
We're speaking with Ben Turk, an anarchist, artist, and anti-prison activist currently based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In this conversation, we'll be chatting about the ongoing hunger strikes initiated by prisoners at Wappen in Wisconsin around the use of long-term solitary confinement and the upcoming September 9th nationwide prisoner strikes on the 45th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising in 1971. Thanks a lot for chatting, Ben.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Can you talk a little bit about the strikes that have been initiated at Wappen CI, like what the deal with, like what are folks protesting, who's involved, and how long has it been going on?
Mm-hmm. So there are a handful of prisoners who have been in solitary confinement, at least one of them for decades, and they're sick of being tortured in that way by the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, and so they initiated a hunger strike, recruited other people to join the hunger strike, and then the DOC was incredibly recalcitrant in response and has begun force-feeding them after only 10 days, which is not at all medically necessary, and they were force-feeding them three times a day, which is completely absurd from like a physician's health concern perspective. The American Medical Association, the World Medical Association, all these different, anybody who has any concern with medical ethics says that force feeding is incredibly dangerous and against the will of the supposed patients and unjustifiable. And yet it seems to be the first response of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections to force feed people. So we look at that situation and say that this is clearly a response to the protest and an attempt to coerce people into going back to eating and ending their hunger strike rather than any kind of medical concern for their health and safety. So we've been fighting against it. We've been supporting the prisoners from the start of the hunger strike. We had some rallies on the 10th and 11th. And then we also went and marched on the Department of Corrections on the 21st with a coalition of prisoner supporters, the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, the Wisdom Network, which is a faith-based network of prisoner advocates here in Wisconsin, Forum for Understanding Prisons, Prison Action Milwaukee, like a large number of groups have been involved in the support, and we're trying to build that coalition and keep it real strong.
Can you talk about what, so there was also, y'all did an action on yesterday on July 5th, right? Outside the DOC. How did that turn out?
Yes. It was good. We got there at, just as the DOC was opening, and put up banners, and we had banners up for all morning until the afternoon, We were there from about 8 in the morning till about 1 or 2, and had media come out, and there's a, so the DOC is this huge building with a large parking lot, so there wasn't anything that we could really block or anything like that, but we, it's also on the intersection of a couple of different highways and major roads, so we were able to put stuff up on overpasses and made a very visible presence there for all day long, and then we went and delivered a letter to the DOC, and they sent down Tristan Cook, who is this kind of slimy guy who they pay to blow people off. He's the PR communications director, and his job is to not communicate with the public or relate to them in any kind of way. And he just says, we're monitoring the situation, and then walks away when we ask more questions. He's done this to us twice now. And so apparently it's just his job to absorb the shame of the Department of Corrections and deflect it. So we need to find a way to get around that and to actually leverage something against the Department of Corrections to show real solidarity with these guys. We're not exactly sure what that is and how to be strategic in the pursuit of that.
Just to jump back for a second.
There was a marching band. That was the coolest thing.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, there's some folks came from Forward Marching Band, which is based in Madison. And so when we went up there, we had tubas, a saxophone, a flute, and played Solidarity Forever and some other songs. And yeah, it was, it added an element of spectacle to the situation.
To jump back for a second, you mentioned that international organizations and like medical organizations say that force feeding is dangerous and unnecessary, but the Wisconsin Department of Corrections is taking that tactic. What are the effects of force feeding on the prisoners? And if it's so negative, how can medical staff implementing force feeding justify this with their Hippocratic oaths to do no harm?
I don't know how they justify it. The concerns, there's a couple of different concerns. One is the possibility that you will puncture the esophagus when you're putting the tube down the throat of an unwilling person. You know, usually tube feeding is something that you do to somebody who's unconscious, in a coma, those kinds of situations. Somebody who is, you know, struggling and refusing and does not want this to happen and is conscious, it's incredibly painful to put a thing down someone's nose. So that's one possibility, is that you tear the esophagus on the way down. Another possibility is that the tube will accidentally go in the trachea instead of the esophagus, and then you end up filling the lungs with fluid. And the other, like, kind of chronic effect is if you go without food for a long time and then you suddenly have a large amount of food in your stomach, then your body reacts to that by sending all of the, like, all, you end up getting dehydrated because your body goes into overdrive digesting that food, and it takes water from elsewhere. And so, yeah, that's the more, like, chronic concern that comes with it. And the DOC, so in Guantanamo, when they force-fed alleged terrorists in Guantanamo, they gave them IV drips to make sure that they wouldn't dehydrate beforehand, and they went through all of these careful procedures to make sure that they didn't harm the people. And it seems pretty clear that that's not going on here in Wisconsin. And so these prisoners who are engaged in a nonviolent protest against solitary confinement in the state of Wisconsin are being treated worse than America's supposed greatest enemies down in Guantanamo Bay. Not that America's greatest enemies deserve to be treated force-fed either, but it just gives a little perspective.
Can you name some of the folks that have been and or are continuing this resistance of hunger strike within the Wisconsin prison system?
Yeah, for sure. The Cesar de Leon is one of the most vocal. He's written a couple of things about the situation, and he seems to be one of the central organizers. They have broken his nose repeatedly by force-feeding him through it. He has a video, so he's fighting against the force-feeding in court, and there was at least one instance where they were force-feeding him and a guard actually assaulted him while the nurse was putting the tube down his throat and pulled the water that was there to lubricate the tube to prevent it from tearing his esophagus out. And so he requested that we get video of that, which was then requested by a judge. So it will become part of the public record in discovery. So we're looking forward to actually seeing how the DOC is administering this dangerous procedure. So that's Cesar de Leon. We also are in touch with, frequently in touch with LaRon McKinley, who has been stalwart and strong on this hunger strike since the start. He has been in solitary confinement for 25 years.
Oh my gosh.
In one prison or another in Wisconsin, yeah. So he's more than fed up with it and is really strong on the strike. And then another guy is Ras Atumra Uhuru Muntawakil. That's his new African name. His state name is Norman Green. He was on the strike from the very start, but he came off after they started force feeding. He was not dealing with the force feeding well. It was difficult for him, and so he came off and has instead been working through the courts on changing some of these things. And he and LaRon, I think, are the main authors of the thing that we delivered on Tuesday, which was a list of recommendations of changes to the policy regarding administrative confinement in the DOC. So these guys, you know, they are doing everything they can to unilaterally negotiate with the Department of Corrections, and they're just getting blocked every step of the way, and the Department of Corrections would rather torture them in order to break this strike then just meet with them, negotiate, you know, concede some of these demands, and the protest and begin the process of ending the torture of solitary confinement, which is a process that's going on across the country. Colorado, New York are kind of leading it. And so eventually Wisconsin's going to get rid of solitary confinement, I believe. The tides are changing on that subject. Because solitary confinement is terrible and a horrible idea. You know, not only is it torturing somebody, it flies in the face of the whole idea of rehabilitation. You're actually breaking people mentally and then putting them back on the street. And so, you know, most people who support prison have this faulty idea that prison is good because it keeps us safe or something like that. But solitary confinement is clearly kind of the most egregious example of how how prison makes communities less safe rather than more safe. So in the long run, it will be done away with. But in Wisconsin, the DOC, being, you know, belligerent, authoritarian people, are not willing to have that change come as a concession to prisoners or activists. And so their ego and their need to have control of everything is, I think, a big part of their recalcitrance.
Yeah, that seems to be a constant recurring theme in the American prison system, whether it be the Lucasville circumstances or any number of other ones since. Ras Atumra Uhuru Muntawakil, as you mentioned, or Norman Green, has been transferred to Columbia Correctional Institution. Can you talk about that for a sec?
Yeah, he was transferred at the very beginning of the strike, actually between when they released the demands and the intention to strike and when the strike started. And there were other prisoners who were also transferred. And it's actually not entirely clear to me that we even know of all of the hunger strikers. It's possible that some of the people that Cesar and LaRon and Uhuru recruited were transferred to other prisons or other wings of the prison and are and don't know how to get a hold of us on the outside and don't know how to get a hold of the prisoners. And the DOC won't even answer questions like how many people are refusing food or how many people are being force-fed. So they might be torturing people in the dark that we don't even know about.
You've mentioned the deleterious effects of solitary confinement and saying that even international institutions have declared that it's a form of torture and ineffective and actually doing the opposite of what is a what is quote unquote desired by the rehabilitation systems of the United States incarceration, like the prison state. Can you talk about what solitary confinement looks like in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what if you were a prisoner put into solitary confinement? What would put you there, supposedly? And also, what would your day to day existence be like? And what sort of avenues for getting out do you have?
Right. The prison, the corrections culture in Wisconsin seems to be very heavily inundated with harassment and provocation. Whether you're talking about the Lincoln Hill Schools for Boys, which is probably going to be shut down by federal investigators right now because of all of the instances of kids being abused, sexually assaulted, and harassed mercilessly in that institution. The same kind of practices are happening in Waupun, in the Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility, which is under the control of Sheriff Clark. So across the board in Wisconsin, the culture seems to be if you can provoke a prisoner by harassing, sexually harassing, and abusing them enough that they will then defend themselves in any way, then you have complete justification to do anything. And I know that's the case in other places as well, but here in Wisconsin, it seems like it's been exposed and there's some attention around it, and yet there's no movement or change. So in Waupun, for example, which is Wisconsin's oldest prison, it was built in 1850s, and it looks like a fortress. The pipes there are lead, so you're drinking poisonous water. You're in a room that's 10 foot by 15 foot, I think, is what they are here in Wisconsin. And you are locked in that room for 23 hours a day. The one day that you have for supposedly outdoor rec is in a different concrete room that's slightly larger. But once you get put in there, the guards will take you out, won't come and take you out if you need to. And so oftentimes prisoners can be left in that room where there's not a bathroom. And so they will urinate or defecate in the corner or something like that because they have to, because the guards aren't accommodating them. And so a lot of times prisoners don't go to the rec cage because it's disgusting and unhygienic. And so people end up staying in their cells for full 24 hours a day, days and days on end. And there's constant harassment and abuse by guards. And there's any pretext that they can come up with to punish you and take away privileges they use. And they particularly target people who are filing grievances against them or who are filing lawsuits. I've heard many stories about people who do that kind of stuff and then just are mercilessly harassed and attacked and targeted by the guards and staff until they get the pretext that they need to lock them down further or extract them from their cell or move them to a restraint chair. Or I've heard stories in Waupun, there used to be a restraint table. And so this is so old that it was like this antique table with restraints on it, and they will cut your clothes off, strap you down to that, and hold you in the same position for hours on end. And so I've heard stories about guys who spend a very long time held in restraint positions on that table, have to urinate or defecate on themselves while there, and are made fun of and laughed at by the staff. Those are some of the things that I've heard about Waupun specifically.
I mean, that seems so, like, by definition, that's torture. That's not, if you have to drag someone into a room to tie them to a table to restrain them, like, obviously you've got them in some sort of restraint on the way over. There's no sort of argument that you can be making that this is for their immediate safety or the safety of people around them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an entirely abusive and coercive and medieval. You know, a lot of times when the UN says that solitary confinement for more than 15 days is torture, a lot of people would be like, oh, no, it's not. That's just the UN being liberal or something like that. But strapping someone to a table for hours in the same position, that is torture. That is unquestionably torture. Spraying them, you know, putting a mask on them and then spraying them with mace in the face when they're already restrained, that's definitely torture. Shooting somebody who is in a cell by themselves with a paintball gun where the paintball pellets are filled with pepper spray, and they can't defend themselves, they can't do anything to stop being shot by this, that's unquestionably torture. Like, these are practices that serve no purpose other than to inflict pain and coerce people into doing what you want them to do, and that is the dictionary definition of torture.
So the strikes that you've been describing in Wisconsin's Waupun Correctional Institution remind me of the strikes, though much less widespread, that twice this last decade hit the west coast of the U.S. against solitary confinement, mostly in California. Mm-hmm. And prisoners around the United States are growing more and more, organized in their protests and resistance and support. And on the outside, it seems to be growing as well against circumstances like solitary confinement, inadequate food or disgusting food, unfair work circumstances, the mass incarceration of people of color and poor people around the U.S. Can you talk a little bit about the upcoming September 9th nationwide strikes that are being called out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the context of all of that action that you just described, whether it's in California, Ohio, Alabama with the Free Alabama Movement, or Texas, there are prisoners who are fighting back and standing up against the system of slavery and torture in the U.S. prison system. And they have called for, and so seeing this happening more and more frequently, they called for a national strike. A friend of mine, Sadiq Abdullah Hassan in Ohio, as well as some of the guys from the Free Alabama Movement were the primary initiators of it, but prisoners all across the country have gotten on board. And they're calling for a shutdown of all the prisons everywhere on September 9th. And the thing that's exciting or powerful about this is that it's direct action. You know, on Tuesday we went to the DOC and we delivered a letter to that Toad guy, and we didn't have any real leverage. We didn't have any real power against them. And so they're going to go on and continue to torture our friends and continue to force feed them. But in the case of a work stoppage or a hunger strike or anything where the prisoners are making it impossible to continue the routines of confinement that they're subjected to, that's direct action. That brings things to a halt, and it throws the prison system into a crisis. And so that is a position of power and leverage that people are able to have against this system. You know, I also think about Black Lives Matter. You know, this week, just this morning, I see multiple news stories about folks who were killed by police, and it's a constant, ongoing and escalating, like, war of police terror and civil war against black and brown people. And our response typically is to go out in the streets and, you know, maybe block a highway, maybe, you know, have a big enough rally or, you know, interrupt some speeches by some politicians. But there's very few angles that we've been able to actually work on, like the material conditions that maintain police terror in this country and white supremacy in this country. And the prison system is a particularly vulnerable spot where they actually depend on the labor of the prisoners to keep it going. And so we can use that vulnerability as leverage and force change instead of just requesting or demanding change.
I think that's really important that you make that connection. I was trying to think of a way to to make that connection as well. There was a shooting this last week in Asheville of a 35-year-old African-American man, J. Latif Sulfig Williams, or Jerry Williams. First, the police claimed that he had a gun, like when he got out of his car and drew it on the officer, who felt afraid, and so he shot Mr. Williams 6 times and killed him. And then witnesses afterwards were like, there were no guns. Like, that guy didn't have a gun. He just got shot.
Mm-hmm.
But between the videotaped shooting in Minneapolis where the lady was, like, his girlfriend was actually, like, on Facebook video streaming what was going on, the interaction with the police, or the shooting in Baton Rouge of Alton Sterling this last week. Yeah, it's just, it's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And the two can't be disconnected.
Right. Yeah. It is all a part of the mass incarceration system, whether it's police, prison, community corrections, ankle bracelets. These are all systems of locking down and maintaining control for the benefit of white supremacy and capitalism. And they are situations that reproduce themselves and continue to maintain, like, a culture and a political economy that is based on abusing people and terrorizing people. And that's the world that we live in, you know? But, you know, you and I, white people, we don't see that world. We don't encounter that world. We don't experience that world most of the time. And so we need to be convinced that it exists. We need to, like, learn and realize it, which is part of the process that I feel like we're under now. But it's not. We're not learning fast enough, and we're not going from that awareness to action quickly enough. Not enough of us are. And so the system continues unabated. And it's overwhelming and depressing sometimes.
So while folks are like actively mobilizing the streets and talking to the neighbors and meeting folks and resisting through Black Lives Matter and related struggles around these shootings, how if somebody doesn't live in a city and they're listening to this, but they don't live in a city where they know anything about the prison or the jail that's nearby, if they don't have a local group like Redbird Prison Abolition or some other group in the area that they can hook up with, or an Anarchist Black Cross chapter or something, how would you suggest that folks, like, start getting involved as September 9th approaches and beyond with getting to know the circumstances of incarceration in their area and building these inside-outside alliances?
Mm-hmm. There are so many different ways to get involved in stuff. You can watch the news, you can pay attention, you can find any time that a prisoner is quoted. Here in Wisconsin, there was a news article about lead in the water at Waupun and one other prison, and so we wrote to the people who gave quotes to those newspapers. You can talk to the ACLU. The ACLU is kind of ubiquitous. It's all over the place. If you're in a mid-sized city, there's probably an ACLU chapter there, and they probably get tons of mail from prisoners that they're not able to respond to as quickly as they would like. And if you can go in there and volunteer with them, you can establish contact that way. Books, prisoners programs are another great way to reach out to people and build those contacts and get things going. And the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee is probably the organization that is most successfully and best resourced and staffed and getting things going on, like, a nationally coordinated level. If you go to iwalk.noblogs.org and go to the contact page there, you will get in touch with people who are actively working to build iWalk branches all across the country. It's a committee of the industrial workers of the world, which I think is incredibly smart and savvy of the IWW to be reaching into prisons and to be thinking about this to be thinking about labor in terms of prison labor and in terms of the people who are most exploited in our current situation. So become a Wobbly, join iWalk, get involved. do Books to Prisoners projects, reach out to people, or reach out to us on a national level. If you go to supportprisonerresistance.net and contact me through that website, I will plug you in with either IWalk or somebody who is active in, I have contacts in every region of the country, if not every state. So we can get you connected with other folks and we can make things happen.
So you mentioned, like, both you and I are white. We don't get affected by prison systems as much. Like, I've never been incarcerated. I don't have many family members who have, but a third of African American males are in one state of, whether it be like on parole, probation, having been incarcerated or incarcerated currently, that affects like voting rights, if that's a thing you want, or gun ownership, or like your ability to get a job, your ability to get housing, get public assistance, any of these things. And that's just African American males, not even talking about the largest growing group of incarcerated people in the United States per capita, which is African American women. I also don't have to, you know, I'm not perpetually under threat of being pulled over and shot by police in a way that if my skin were dark or if I had more melanin in it, then that would be a daily reality, that a police officer could feel threatened by me because of my not whiteness and decide to take me out of their fear. So there's like these realizations that I have, and so what would you say is like an argument for someone who is not affected in these day-to-day things outside of just like, it is wrong that these are a circumstance? Can you talk about, like,
I mean, everybody's liberation is connected to
all right
each other.
Yeah.
You know?
Go into that, can
yeah
you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's important. It's not just that I am anti-racist, that I care about prison abolition. You know, prison disproportionately incarcerates black folks, but it doesn't exclusively incarcerate black folks. And the police don't exclusively shoot black folks, you know? They do disproportionately. Racism is definitely a huge piece of that, and police are far more likely to feel threatened by black folks driving in the car or whatever. But the police are still increasingly aggressive across the board in this country, and we are increasingly living in a police state where none of us are free. We are, you know, it's yes, the person looking at the footage from the surveillance camera is less likely to think that I'm up to something when they see the color of my skin, or less likely to care if I'm up to something when they see the color of my skin, but they're still seeing me when I might be up to something. There's still this lockdown culture going on, and it is still enabling and perpetuating a state of poverty and a state of exploitation that we are all subject to. I don't live the life of somebody who, you know, was born into an over-policed neighborhood and had my father or my brother or my mother or, you know, kidnapped by the police. But I do interact with people who have had that experience. They are part of the society that I live in, and they've been traumatized by that experience, and they've been harmed by that experience. And if I'm going to share in community with those people, then it is in my interest for them to not be subjected to this kind of trauma and harm and this systematic terrorism by the white supremacist police state that we live under. So, you know, I mean, I guess I could be like the guy on the swim team who, I don't even want to talk about that guy because he's disgusting, but like, you know, I could roll with my white privilege and I could embrace it and I could be happy about it and I could just be like, yeah, I can do whatever the heck I want and there'll be no consequences for me. But I can't feel good about myself in that situation. I can't, there's no self-worth that comes with achieving success by the standards of a white supremacist society. And there's nothing that feels positive about that. And you have to do so much like mental gymnastics to justify or ignore the like virulent racism that is, that permeates our society, you know? And I'm not capable of doing those mental gymnastics, and I'm baffled by people who are.
Word. Well, thanks a lot for putting that so well. Succinctly. I don't know why it was so hard for me to just say, like, our liberations are linked up with each other. But yeah, very well put.
Thank you.
Yeah. Is there anything else you wanted listeners to know about in this immediate circumstance?
No, just, I mean, we're seeing a lot building right now. There's a lot of people doing a lot of the background work to build this prison movement for September 9th and beyond. And we just encourage people to get involved in that and to stay involved in that. I know now that it's summertime and the weather's nice, everybody wants to go out and barbecue and stuff like that. But keep this on your mind. Keep this as part of a priority in your life. Because we can really win. We can make things happen. We can change these circumstances. There is a solid strategy coming out of these prisoners from Hassan and Kinetic and Melvin Ray and so many other prisoners, you know, Cesar and the other folks that I've interacted with. They're smart. They know what they're doing. They know how to leverage power. They know how to organize. And all that they need is for us to meet them in that. And we can rend real concessions and changes out of the system that we're all oppressed by.
And if in the immediate circumstances of what's going on in Wisconsin, if folks want to find out more, would you direct them to solitarytorture.blogspot.com or?
Yes, that's the most thorough website on the hunger strike. But we also, you know, continually put updates on supportprisonerresistance.net.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Ben Turk, anti-prison activist, anarchist, and artist, currently up in Wisconsin. Thank you so much for spending this time and helping us parse through these ideas.
Thank you for having me and all the other guests that you've had talking about these issues. Your radio show is awesome.
You're awesome.
No, you are.
No, you. Jeez. Next, we'll hear a track from the recent release by With the End in Mind. The track is called Anguish Symmetry, and Unraveling Arising is the song. After that, we'll hear Arbor with the title track from the 2012 Plutonian Shore.
The dirty to fight.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXEF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of this show, you're free to do so. Just send us an email so we know you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.
The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events on their website at firestorm.coop.